Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. On the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name. The echo is haunting. The echo is always the same. I call your name. The echo is haunting. An echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
Welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg, and we have an illustrious guest today, Lloyd Auerbach. Before I introduce Lloyd, if you are so inclined to call in with a question, you can, and the number here is 888-627-6008. I feel like I know Lloyd for 100 years, but I should be able to do his bio without reading, but I'm going to read it. Lloyd's a world-recognized paranormal authority and a parapsychologist. He has 45-plus years of experience. Really? 45-plus years?
Yeah.
investigating the paranormal and over 40 years teaching courses in parapsychology. He has thousands of media appearances, literally. He's the director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations. He's president of Forever Family Foundation. He's an adjunct professor at Atlantic University, president of the board of directors of the Rhine Research Center, where he teaches online parapsychology courses through the Rhine Education Center. He's the author and co-author of 9 books on the paranormal for the general public, including the second edition of a paranormal casebook, as well as ESP Wars, East and West, Psychic Dreaming, the classic ESP, Hauntings and Poltergeists, a Parapsychologist's Handbook. He's the co-author of the paranormal mystery novels Near Death and Afterlife, the second of the series. Currently, you can see him in episodes of The Unexplained, running on a few streaming platforms, Surviving Death on Netflix, and a number of other shows still streaming on various platforms. His website, where you could learn a lot more, is lloydauerbach.com. Lloyd spells his last name, AUERBACH.com. He has a YouTube channel a lot of other things. So you go on his website, lloydauerbach.com, and you'll learn a lot more. Welcome, Lloyd.
Thank you, Bob.
Big difference is I need glasses now to read, you know. So. what do we want to talk about? We've talked a lot over the years. And then it just dawned on me, we could talk about a million things, but
yeah,
we still constantly get pretty much the same questions regarding the main area of your expertise, and you have many different areas, and you're well informed on disciplines of research. But you know, one of the questions, let me ask you the questions that people often ask us, because I'm probably giving them the wrong information and you won't. So let's start off with something simple. Is there a difference between a ghost and an apparition?
Well, we use in parapsychology, we've been using the term apparition probably since the late 1800s, to represent the idea of consciousness surviving death and being interacting with us living people. So that's what most people call a ghost. The problem with the word ghost is there's so much baggage from pop culture, you know, movies, TV, literature, all sorts of stuff. And even cross-culturally, the word ghost or translations of that means slightly different things to different people. So we tend to use apparition for that. But I will often interchange those two terms, because I think most people understand that a ghost is conscious, is still, you know, here. You know, as well as I do, that the mediums often make a distinction between a ghost and a spirit. You know, spirit is someone on the other side. Ghost is someone who hasn't gone to the other side yet. So there is that as well. And then we make a distinction between that and a haunting, which is a little different as well.
Yeah, well, we can get into that, but you're absolutely right. It's funny, people, the fear factor comes in and often in the discussion of ghosts, but yet if they have an apparition from their loved one, it's something that they would cherish, so
Right,
that's
right.
why I understand why you might use the terms interchangeably. So also what I hear a lot is from various people, I've even heard it from some mediums, is that ghosts are people that are stuck, that
Yeah.
they're deceased, but they're stuck in some dimension in between here and there.
Well, they're not stuck in some dimension in between here. They're stuck here, like the same that we're stuck here.
Yeah.
But even living people are stuck in their lives. I mean, we get stuck in all sorts of stuff, don't we? And really,
Yeah.
what we've heard over the years, what we've seen in research, what we've heard from mediums, from psychics, from witnesses who have communicated with the ghosts, the apparitions who are here, is a myriad of reasons why that individual apparition is still around. It can run from the apparition wanting to stick around and look over after their family. I mean, in other words, one of the things we hear is that the living sometimes keep the ghost stuck because they're not letting go of their grief. So the apparition, that person who is deceased, is trying to get across to them that they're okay before they move on. So that's a form of being stuck. Fear is an interesting thing. People, some apparitions seem to be, they're not aware of what's next. And given their religious upbringing, they may be afraid of going on to the next step. And then we hear also that there is the confusion that they don't know what they're, some of them claim that they don't know that they're dead. You have to convince them. I find that other than the fact that people can be in denial, living people can be in denial of getting a terminal illness diagnosis. Other than that, I don't know how someone who's walking around without a body or run flying around without a body could figure out that they're, can't figure out that they're dead in some way. There's the unfinished business. I mean, there's all these different reasons. Sometimes it's just, I mean, I've got cases where they're trying to protect something else. That's the USS Hornet Aircraft Carrier Museum. We have cases where the apparitions just are having too much fun. They had fun in life. They're going to stick around and have continue to be at the same place and hang out for a while with the living.
It's interesting because one thing that you mentioned, which is another question that we get in comments that we get all the time, is that am I holding my loved one back with my grief?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
Not in any sort of magical, mystical way, but in a psychological way, potentially.
Yeah. Well, if anything, it's an incentive to try to have a living your life with some meaning and purpose and not dwelling on that constantly, so even if there's a possibility that it's holding them back. So it seems that obviously, so we see apparitions, sometimes people see them, and it must take a lot of energy for this entity of energy on the other side to manifest a physical form.
Actually, no.
No? Why
No.
is
That whole manifestation thing comes back from the spiritualist days and especially from some of the fraudulent spiritualist mediums in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It's consciousness. So there's no manifestation happening. I think the best way to explain it is that you could have a room and an apparition in the room, and there's 10 people there. And two people see the apparition. One of them hears the apparition's voice as well. Another person hears the voice but doesn't see the apparition. Another person senses, smells perfume associated with that person. Another individual, actually several of them, might actually feel a presence but not get any idea of who that is. And then there's three people who had, like, what are you people? You're nuts? It's telepathy. I mean, it's basically that there's a consciousness floating around that projects or thinks of themselves the way they look, the way they sound, the way they smell. It's like self-identity. And that is what us living people pick up. When somebody doesn't pick that up, it's because they're not either psychically open or they're blocking. And the reason why some people have different sensory experiences is because we all process information differently. I mean, even the mediums don't talk about getting a visual or an auditory or their clairaudient, their clairsentient. They talk about different experiences, sensory experiences. And it's the same thing. It's about how we receive the signal, which may have all the information, but it doesn't take any particular energy that we're aware of to do that.
So it's possible that all discarnates are around us all the time. It's just that we may not be able to
It's
perceive it.
possible, but there's enough people that are really good at perceiving apparitions that that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah. Well, it kind of ties into the question that a lot of people have is why do my friends, get communications and I don't? It's they worry that their loved one on the other side is angry with them or some make up some other reason,
Maybe they're
but
busy.
or it has or their non-physical senses are not advanced enough to the point where they can perceive it.
Right. Yeah, there's probably, I mean, we don't know what all the rules are on the other side. We do know that, it's not when you work with a medium, it's not dial a spirit. So, as you well know, in some of the group sessions we've seen and other sessions over the years, that somebody dearly wants to talk to their father and their mother comes through. It's like, I don't want to talk to my mother, I want to talk to my father. Well, your father doesn't want to talk to you right now, or he's not available, is usually what we hear.
And the question of whether, ghosts or apparitions can speak, again, it goes back to what you were saying before. I mean, I know that investigators sometimes catch electronic voice phenomena, which tends to show that they can imprint their voices on devices.
That, yeah, and that's the key, is imprint, not speak. So it's not an acoustical sound. It is, that's by definition, electronic voice phenomena is voices that are imprinted into the recording medium. It could be an effect on the device. It could be something else. Those voices could also come from us, from living people too.
So if somebody has what we term as a dream visitation, during certain stages of sleep. They have an encounter with a deceased loved one and it's very tactile and sometimes they can have conversations. And so in essence, they're really encountering an apparition in their dream.
Those kinds of dreams, they have a very, very different context and sensation to them. I mean, psychic dreams in general. The dream state's one in which pretty much anything goes. So we tend to be much more psychic or open to psychic information. And therefore, if there is a spirit or a local apparition that wanted to communicate, that would be one way of actually doing it. Again, that's still mind to mind in that sense.
It's a hard concept for people to understand that how communication with discarnates can be a psychic exercise, but it's still mind-to-mind
It
communication.
is. I mean,
One of the
mediums
parties
communicate.
involved doesn't have a body, but they still have
Right.
a body.
Yeah, that's the thing. And the other side of that, though, is also it's something that I think it really comes up when I'm teaching some of my classes, and especially when I'm encountering ghost hunters. Have they ever thought about how the apparition can see you? Because they don't have physical eyes. They don't have eardrums to hear you. It's all psychic. So they're using ESP and we're using ESP. It is definitely a connection in that way. It's an informational connection.
And as you point out in your writings, psychokinesis, the power of consciousness or the mind to affect matter, exists on both sides, right? I mean,
Yeah,
so
yeah. I mean,
whether
we have much more evidence of that in living people than we do in dead people. An interesting thing that I've noted over the years, and I talked to other investigators about this, is there the cases where there's physical activity and an apparition, sometimes the two things are not necessarily related. They're not caused by the apparition, it's caused by the living for a particular reason, unconsciously. But for those apparitions, they seem to have to learn to actually do this. It's not an automatic thing for them. They're for the first time without a body, and they have to try to figure out how to influence things. I think a really good example in pop culture is the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze, and he has to learn. He encounters a ghost on the New York subway, and the ghost is knocking newspapers out of people's hands on the subway just for the heck of it. And he corners the ghost and, "How are you doing this?" He says, "What? You don't have a physical body. You got to think. You got to move it with your mind." And so he has to practice, and eventually he can move a penny. Oh boy. Probably for a few months later, he could move a lot more.
Right. So the other term that has some connotations of fear involved is hauntings. So explain how a haunting is different than a ghost or an apparition.
Well, first, apparitions are not tied to a location any more than we are. They still may stick around a location because that's where they lived, or that's the bar they went to, the restaurant they really love to go to, something like that. And I just have to remind everybody, the word haunt refers to a location, a place. And if you watch old movies from the 30s and 40s, especially the film noir, they're always talking about going to the guy's old haunts.
Right.
Right. If you watch Cheers, Norman Cliff, absolutely haunting Cheers while they're alive. So regulars anywhere are haunting the place in that sense. So a haunting refers generally to, in the paranormal context, refers to a recording of some past person or event. When I say past, it could be 2 days ago or it could be 50 years ago. And that event or person's actions are recorded into the environment. And we, as living people with some psychic ability, pick it up under certain physical conditions that we're still trying to pin down for that. They're repetitive. They're not interactive any more than you could talk to a movie on your TV screen and expect a direct answer. It's a recording. And very often, ghost hunters refer them to them as residual hauntings. They're often referred to as psychic imprints, things like that. There's a lot, and that's the most common. In fact, probably the most common haunting experience that so many, probably most people have experienced. If you've ever gone house hunting or apartment hunting, and you walk into a place and it's not the decor and it's not the smell or the neighborhood, and you get a bad vibe, there's a really good reason, likely, that that is because of the people living there and the emotions that they are expressing in that place, which kind of get imprinted. So we pick up emotion a lot more than we pick up even visual stuff for that.
So the residual, imprint of energy in these places goes on indefinitely, or usually there's a set
Well,
amount of time, you know?
we're not sure exactly what the mechanism is. It seems like it might be connected to the Earth's magnetic field on a very, very local level. It is unknown at this point what the full conditions are to imprint everything and then even to access it, what the reasons are for that, because not everybody experiences this. So we're still a little bit off on this, but we do know that new things record over old things. That's pretty clear. In fact, if somebody were to move, in fact, when we moved into this house where we were, the previous owners turned out to be a little sketchy, let's say. The woman's husband had already gone back to Thailand. She was a they're both white, both Christians. He was from Thailand. She was a white Christian here, and they were starting a ministry in Thailand based on a deadly martial art, if you can believe this. That's a heck of a thing to base a Christian ministry on.
Yeah.
There were some things that happened as we bought the house, like things that they had claimed that they had done to the house to fix it up, which were actually done service-wise. So there was a lot of bad juju on the wall, so to speak. And a friend of mine, you could feel it sometimes, a friend of mine who runs a school that I was teaching at actually suggested during our open house that we all walk around the house. We were going to be painting in the next couple of weeks. Walk around the house, think of our happiest memories, touch the walls and the floor as we think of our happiest memories. And by the time that was done, the house felt great.
Huh.
It's a very, very simple thing. So when people talk about house clearings because something feels bad,
Yeah.
it's a psychic thing that people can do. But you can do that yourself. You don't need to smudge with sage. You need the intention. If you don't have the intention, smudging with sage does nothing other than to make it the house smell like pot, pretty much.
Right.
So it's really, hauntings can be recorded over. Hauntings are also positive. One of my earliest cases involved a couple who were still alive. That's the thing. Hauntings are left by living people, not by dead people. The recordings are made by the living like any other recording. And this was a case in which the new couple that moved into the house, which was only six, less than 6 years old. The previous owners were young. They had moved away. They were hearing in the middle of the night, they were hearing two people making love loud in the next room. So those noises were waking them up.
Yeah.
And when I talked to finally tracked down the previous owner and talked to him about this, it's like he confirmed what the imprint was. He was surprised, but he confirmed about it. And we gave him a suggestion how to fix it, which they did.
Yeah.
So, recordings can be positive, they can be negative, they can be annoying, they
Yeah.
can be scary.
Right. All right, so we have, apparitions that are conscious. We have hauntings where there's no consciousness involved at all,
Recordings, yeah.
recordings, and then you have poltergeists, which also is not a conscious entity. But yet, I mean, explain that, because that's what people see on TV with things flying around the
Right,
room.
right. And we do have cases going back hundreds of years with objects moving, things flying around. The term poltergeist goes back at least as far as the 16th century in Germany. And so think about this. This is the 1500s when people were being accused of witchcraft, by the way. For the simplest things. And some there were cases that were on record that things were flying around, including the chamber pot full. So, there may be a couple of inceptions of some phrases we use, like something hitting the fan, so to speak. And the
It
term
really did
poltergeist
hit
means,
the
yeah. The
fan,
term poltergeist, that's my speculation.
huh?
The term poltergeist actually refers to noisy or mischievous ghosts. So at that time, they only, people only thought, they didn't think psychic. They didn't think psychokinesis or mind over matter at all. They thought it has to be spirits or something else. I mean, it was 1,000 years before that, it was the gods that were doing that. So there was no way for them conceptually to come up with the idea that human beings were involved. In the early 20th century, and even there were inklings in the late 19th century, but in the early 20th century, a researcher, parapsychologist, psychoanalyst named Nandor Fodor did some cases and came up with the concept that it was really the living, someone living in the environment. It was an expression of unconscious stress and tension. And that's where we are today. This has been kind of tested in many ways that most of the poltergeist cases where there's physical activity, and it runs the gamut of actually moving objects. These days, we have a lot of electronics going off or doing weird things when somebody is totally stressed out. And it doesn't happen to everybody, but it's the unconscious mind of an individual that is blown off steam in one way, shape, or form for about 70% of the cases. There's a percentage of them based on research that may have to do with neurological issues like epilepsy or epileptiform activity in the temporal lobes, almost like it's a seizure that's going outward instead of inward. So it's still, we still connect that to the living. And the activity in poltergeist cases is chaos, whereas the activity when it's physical, which is rare in apparition cases, I can't say it's orderly, but it's intentional and rarely ever destructive. Unless, of course, you're totally ignoring that apparition, and pissing them off.
Nobody likes to be ignored.
No. I kind of liken it to a 2-year-old who's ignored, so.
Right. Yeah. Well, that, to me, the poltergeist phenomena is almost even more difficult to grasp than communicate, the afterlife, because the power of the mind, and sometimes to move heavy, objects is really incredible itself, right?
It boggles our minds. That's why we have something called the boggle factor
Yeah.
as well. I mean, I've worked with people who could do PK, psychokinesis, not big stuff, but I've seen bigger stuff moving in cases as well. The thing about it is that we can get it to stop by identifying who that individual is and working with them. So it doesn't take much to work with them to get it to stop, which is very different than if there's a spirit that nobody's detected. And that's one of the other things about poltergeist cases is, in general, you bring in a psychic or medium who's proven out that they can pick up ghosts and spirits and stuff, and they'll kind of look at you and go, yeah, there's nobody here, while things are moving.
I know. The so as an investigator, I know you don't go out on many cases anymore, but you know, I mean, you used to go out on a lot. So you, I mean, your job is to rule out physical explanations first, right? And
We rarely have to debunk a case as they talk about on TV, because that implies fraud. It's almost never fraud. It's we're looking for so one of the things ghost hunters often do, unfortunately, is they if one thing happens that might really be paranormal, the entire everything that people reported must be paranormal. So we actually look at the overall case, but we also look at every little event that they are reporting, every encounter, every experience. Because I find, and most of my colleagues have found, that when you get people on edge, they will suddenly assume that maybe a glass falling off a table because you didn't see anybody bump it, that must have been paranormal. A picture frame falls down because the nail kind of worked its way out. They hear weird noises at night. Yeah, that's the wind and hitting a tree against the house settling noises. All of that gets grouped into the same possibly real case. So we have to look at every little event and look for, is there an explanation for each one of these pieces? And if there is, let's push those aside and see what might really be psychic slash paranormal, what might be really going on here.
So before we went on air, you showed me a new piece of equipment that you had, which looks pretty extraordinary. So maybe for those that are watching this video, can you show hold that up?
I will. So first I should say that parapsychologists, when we do investigations, unlike the TV shows, we're using equipment to detect what's going on in the environment. We're not using, there's nothing that can detect ghosts other than maybe a medium or psychic or other living people. So we're really not using technology to detect anything paranormal. We are using it to sometimes rule things out, for sure. But we try to look for, we'll do a baseline. So let's do some readings when nothing's happening. With an EMF meter, with temperature sensors, with all sorts of sound analysis, things like that. And then let's see what happens, what we get when something is being experienced, whether it's by one of the witnesses or a medium or psychic that's in the place. And we look for the differences there. So I have a number of different, I have a couple of EMF sensors, I have some other equipment, and I just recently, this is a fun thing because I am a Star Trek fan. So this is actually, I was on a wait list for a year for this. It only they started manufacturing this recently. This is actually a working tricorder. All right, and let me just go ahead and turn it on. Get this to come up. There we go. So it's coming up now. So it actually has a video screen. It has sensors in it. Let me go ahead. I don't know if you can hear the noise it's making. Maybe not. It might be screened out by Zoom. Let me go back and do this. But it actually has working sensors in it, which is really kind of cool. Go back here. And so it has an EMF sensor in it. I'm not going to turn this on right now, but it has an EMF sensor in it. It has atmospheric sensors in it, so I have now have the tool that actually does a lot of things at one time. It has a very sensitive sound sensor and shows me a visual of what's going on there. So it really does a great job at a number of things. Plus, it actually has some good Star Trek stuff because it actually has data disks with all captain's logs and tons of other Star Trek stuff.
And you don't have to lug all the equipment anymore.
No, I mean I can
It's
just
all
use
in one.
one piece of equipment. That's right. I mean, I'll still have a few other things that I'm using. I just know that there won't be a lot of ghost hunters using this. But I also know that if because I do some television shows once in a while, they will probably never let me put this on TV. Because, without Paramount's permission or something.
Right. Did so I know you get asked, I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask you for the listeners, have you personally ever seen or sensed the presence of an apparition?
I have. I can say honestly that I didn't at all for quite some time. And then I've worked with a number of psychics and mediums over the years. I started noticing that I was sensing some stuff and didn't know exactly, because it was actually hauntings and apparition cases. I would kind of sense an area where something was going on. And I started without saying to the psychic or medium I was working with, I'd kind of direct them around the room as I'm doing readings with the environmental sensors. And I'd sometimes kind of push them over to where I was picking something and finding that, there was something that they were picking up. And then eventually, because I was working with a restaurant called the Moss Beach Distillery south of San Francisco, with a ghost that had been around, a woman had been around since the early 1930s. A lot of people witnessed her. We had a really interesting interaction with a Japanese medium for Japanese TV, where she gave the ghost fashion advice. And a couple weeks later, I start getting calls from the employees like, it's the same woman I've seen before, but she's now wearing a little black dress. She's no longer the blue lady. She's not wearing blue clothes anymore. She changed her clothes. And eventually, because I was down there so often with Annette Martin, especially a psychic medium I work with, eventually I started feeling her presence. And then one night, we were doing a two late night session all throughout the place, and that was there. I had a couple other psychics, one other medium, and another psychic there, and I was alone behind the bar, after hours, and felt something happening. And I actually felt something walking through me, and had a mental image of this woman, and started timing it. And I was not getting any unusual readings otherwise, but I was timing it. And about 2.5 minutes later, as she's walking back and forth with through me, and it was very giggly, Annette and the two other psychics came around the corner, and they stopped and looked at me and started laughing. And Annette said, "Oh, she's walking through you, isn't she?" And then I felt it, the energy move, her moving away. And one of the others said, "I think we scared her off." So, and after that, I could sense whenever she was around.
So, what was the sensation like, or was there? I mean, did you feel like energy was passing through your body?
The closest I could liken it to is if you've ever stood in the surf and, the waves come in and kind of make your body rock a little bit. That's kind of what it felt like. But it also had this tinge of, tingly, and I say giggly. It was because she was giggling as she was, that's the sense I was getting. And I could kind of get that sense as well.
Interesting. The so it's I think you've said that you can't really photograph an apparition,
Right.
but yet we see all these photographs, that people post all the time, or take themselves, where it appears there's an uncanny likeness to what we imagine, an apparition to look like. So
Right, right. Well, a
you
lot of those are, frankly, especially on the internet these days, a lot of them are fake. If an apparition is going to appear on any medium at all, including, like I said, the EVP from before, they have to intentionally affect the device or the recording medium. So there's an intention. So for someone to be photographed as a ghost, they would have to affect the device intentionally.
Right.
They're not reflecting light. I mean, if the thing is, if you could take a picture of a ghost that was, if it was optical, you would see it, what you're taking a picture of. You would also, everybody would see that, because light is either being given off by that apparition or being reflected. So there's just no condition under which the human eye can pick up something that the camera can't, or vice versa.
Which doesn't mean that the apparition doesn't exist. It just means that we
Right.
don't have the apparatus to perceive it.
That's right. That's right.
So I know you've written about this and talked about cases where people that are living can go out of their body, and their image, is recognized by somebody else in a distant location. So they're in two places at the same time. It's sort of like bilocation. So in essence, they're living apparitions, right?
We have so many cases of living apparitions, although they're not necessarily always tied back to an out-of-body experience, because sometimes people are dreaming and they don't realize that they're doing that, or they're in a near-death experience and they don't realize that that's happening also. But we have cases going back. It's one of the early categories of apparitions going back to the 1800s. And we have research on out-of-body experience. The out-of-body experience is common in many near-death experiences, but not necessarily all of them. And it just seems that certain people have a connection with whoever is out of their body, and or there are certain conditions for that individual, and they can see the apparition in that way.
Yeah. Well, I know that I always found it odd that there are usually, especially in a hospital in the operating room when somebody, codes and has a near-death experience, and then when they come back, they try to put into words, the fact that they left their body and they were at a different vantage point. But yet nobody ever sees, this their soul or their apparition when they're up on the ceiling, so to speak,
I have to wonder if, given the focus on getting that person resuscitated, if there's any instance where someone happens to look at the ceiling.
Right, that's
I mean,
true.
the doctors, people in the operating room are focused.
Right.
And we know that when people are focused, even on something right in their field of view, they won't necessarily consciously see it because
Yeah,
they're focused on something else.
I know that. That's why the experiment where they with a lot of different hospitals, where they put various images near the ceiling, trying to find out if people that went out of body during an NDE would recognize it. But the same thing. I mean, I know in real life I don't recognize half the stuff that's in the room or
Well, yeah, and
around the
that's th
room.
this is the other issue. Charlie Tart did some experiments back in the 60s with
Yeah.
out-of-body experiences where he had numbers, which probably were not the best target to use,
Yeah.
on a shelf above a person who was supposedly able to go out of their body.
Yeah.
And he had some positive results. It wasn't great. The ASPR, American Society for Psychical Research, in the 70s and 80s did research with Alex Tanis, a psychic medium who could do out of body. And I worked there for a while, and we had a contraption where you had to actually look through a lens in front of this big box to see a combination image that was created. And
Right.
he very often got it, although interestingly enough, he got it as if he was upside down, which was very very telling. So it's one of those things that he was intentionally to look through that lens. But someone who is in a near-death experience in a hospital, personally, I might not even notice unless I knew in advance. And how would you know that if you're, undergoing something in the hospital? How would you know that there's a shelf and a picture facing, the surgeon doesn't say to you, "By the way, if you go out of your body, have a
Yeah.
near-death experience." What do you mean I'm going to have a near-death experience?
Yeah.
That's a scary thing for someone.
Right.
Look down and tell us what the picture is later. It's like,
Yeah. Yeah.
they'd
It's
have to
not.
notice. I'd be more interested in what the doctors are doing to my body than I
Right.
would
Yeah. Yeah. It's
anything
a good
else.
point. Well, but that famous case with Charlie Tart and that Mrs. Z, when, it was a five-digit number,
Yeah.
and supposedly she nailed it.
Yeah.
The odds are 100,000 to one of guessing it. So,
And there are those near-death experiences where there is the case where the woman flew out of her body, was out of her body, not only could later on describe what was going on to her body, but also to the next operating theater, went to another floor through the hospital, saw a sneaker out on the ledge on third or fifth floor, which you couldn't see from the ground, and she had never been to that room. There was other descriptions, and this has happened in other situations too. But the question is, if they had a picture facing the ceiling, would she have floated out of her body at the right angle, number one? Would she have thought to look for that? All of those things. Would she have
Yeah.
noticed it?
The cases like the one you described with the sneakers, and I know there's another case where somebody was coding in an ambulance on the way to the hospital and then rose out of his body. So he was at the ceiling of the ambulance and at the same time was at the hospital where his family was gathering, which tells you some, a little bit about insight into the nature of consciousness that it can be in many places at the same time. It
Right.
you split, and the spiritualist community would say that that's what the soul is like. We're all different fragments of a greater oversoul. So I guess the
Yeah,
same.
Alex Tanis used to talk about when he goes out, went out of his body, part of his consciousness split off like a space probe, that, his spirit didn't leave his body. It was just part of his consciousness.
It's not only portrayed in media, but some researchers have looked into this. So what are your thoughts about possession cases?
I have a hard time with possession cases for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is the use of that term. It has significant negative connotations, except in anthropology. Technically, when a medium, and there are mediums that go into trance and let a spirit come in for a time, right? That's possession. That is possession. The difference is the way it's normally used, especially in religious contexts, is a forcible takeover of someone, and the inability to get them out. And yet, every medium I know who's done trance work or has had kind of somebody hop in while something else was going on has basically said, "Yeah, all I got to do is like mentally say, get the hell out of my body," and they're gone. Because this is what Annette Martin used to say, "I'm alive, they're dead. I got more power, even if I weren't a psychic medium. I have much more power." So one has to consider that if something is happening that might be otherwise targeted or tagged as a possession case, number one, what is it about this individual that allowed something to come in and stay there? Why isn't this person taking control? And I think that, that person may psychologically may be in a state of kind of victim mentality, and there's something else going on for that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I tend to think it's more likely, there is that thing called spirit attachment, where somebody who's dead gloms onto you, and usually gloms onto somebody who has very similar issues. They're just as neurotic as you are. Or you were, they are addicted, they're alcoholics, they're addicted to something, they're obsessive compulsive, there's something, and suddenly whatever that issue is gets worse because now you have a codependency issue going on.
So somebody that was an alcoholic might try to stay close to somebody in the physical world that's an alcoholic,
Because now they get to taste the alcohol
living
through them.
vicariously through them.
Exactly. They get to taste the alcohol through this person. They get a taste of that. And hypnosis, there is a technique in hypnosis called spirit releasement therapy, where hypnosis allows, can help release that spirit, kind of separate those things.
We know there are a lot of cases in the history of autistic savants having these incredible psychic powers.
Right.
And I know Diane Powell and others are currently doing research, and some of the autistic savants are incredibly psychic. What do you speculate is happening there? Do you think that they are able to access fields of information that the rest of us can't, or is it did they awaken hidden senses? I mean, you have any theories about that?
I tend to think that they are wired a little differently. So the wiring in the brain is different for them. The processes are different. We know the communication and other issues can be difficult for them. So because of that, they may without realizing it, they may be noticing or relying more about the things that we could do if we didn't have all this other stuff in front of it. I mean, one of the things that Jim Carpenter, who's in our field, wrote a book, James Carpenter wrote a book called First Sight. And it's a theory, a model of ESP that we are all constantly scanning the environment, even a few seconds in advance. Sometimes we pay attention, something will pop up that we pay attention to, but for the most part, the thing to remember is that our normal senses are very good and we're focused on them. So unless something is like the shiny keys that gets our attention, why in the world would we need to even use ESP for some of these things? But for folks who are different, wired differently, neurodivergent, there may be a need for communication, for other things to connect in different ways to the environment, to other people, and that would push aside the normal stuff that gets in the way for us.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. One thing that always comes up, and it could be so many things, is deja vu. I mean, some people say that, deja vu is nothing more than us remembering dreams that we had in the past. Others say, it's precognition. Or retrocognition. Or you have any theories about what deja vu is?
All of the above. I subscribe to what the work of Vernon Nepi, who is a psychiatrist up in Washington State these days. He actually did his PhD dissertation on deja vu back in the, I think it was around 1980 when he published from South Africa. But in that book, and then subsequently in all his research, I think he's up to 48 different possible explanations for an individual deja vu. Some of them are psychic. Many of them are not, are perceptual or tricks of the mind. So some tricks of memory, things like that. There's all sorts of possible explanations. For me, I've had a number of deja vus where because I don't normally remember my dreams. The only time I was really doing that was when I was writing my book, Psychic Dreaming. The entire time I was remembering almost all my dreams. I don't remember them otherwise most of the time. So I would be in a situation that suddenly felt, well, this is really weird. This feels really familiar. And the dream would come rushing back to me. So I tagged it back to something that was originally precognitive, but didn't know, except there have been a number, very few, but a number of occasions where I was with other people and the situation came back to me and I remembered the whole dream. I knew exactly what the people were going to say next. And I would usually say it at the same time just to freak them out.
Really? So you've been hiding all these abilities from us, Lloyd.
They pop up every once in a while. They're totally spontaneous. My friends don't necessarily appreciate it when I've done that to them, but there's a little bit of Bill Murray, Peter Venkman in me, I think, from Ghostbusters. You
Yeah, I bet.
got to have fun with life, right?
That's true. We have enough of the crap. You gotta have
Yeah, that's right.
some fun. Yeah. Did I meant to ask you this before. Why is it that so many people, especially, ghost hunters, go to cemeteries? I mean, never made sense to me.
It makes no sense. I mean, it's never made any sense to me. Never. I think, obviously that's where the dead are buried, so people have this association with that. And there's folklore around the world is that you don't want to be there after dark because the dead come back. But there's no really good evidence at all that A, you're going to stick around your body for several days, unless you're Jewish, in which case you're in the ground really fast. But you're going to stick around with your body for several days after the mortician is done stuff. Maybe you stick around to go to your funeral, but why in the world would you be tied to your body in the cemetery? And I can't think of a more boring place to hang out at all. I mean, maybe there's parties going on in cemeteries we don't know about, but I love going to cemeteries during the daytime and looking, for historical purposes. We have an entire city south of San Francisco, Colma. Their tagline is where the dead outnumber the living. There are more people buried in Colma than there are residents of Colma, and there's some really cool monuments and really cool historical personages that were buried there. And I've been to Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, which is really, really interesting and also really beautiful. And you can see the bridge that the headless horseman supposedly rode over as well. So those kinds of things are really interesting, but there's no indication that spirits actually hang out there. I could
Yeah,
only imagine maybe some caretakers after they die.
right. And if you believe in that life continues after the death of the physical body, then
Yeah.
you have to realize that the person is not there. The person is elsewhere.
Right,
Now,
exactly.
and I understand why people who have lost loved ones visit the cemetery. They feel a closeness with that person.
Yes, absolutely.
I totally get that. Then there are other people like me that I've never been back to. After the funeral, I don't go back because I don't think of my loved ones as being there. They're not there. They're
No, but
gone.
the I think the headstone is a way to connect with them sometimes
Yeah.
mentally. I really absolutely understand that. But it's just, I think the reason ghost hunters love that is because it's a spooky thing to do. I mean, it's not
Right.
just ghost hunters. Teenagers hang out at cemeteries because it's a
And
spooky
drink.
thing to do.
This teenagers drink in cemeteries. I don't know what that's
Right. It's a
all
spooky thing to do.
about. Yeah. Well, they're bringing their own spirits.
Right.
So
Well, that's why bars are haunted so often.
yeah. So is there a 10th book coming?
I'm working on something. I'm hoping to work on a couple of things before the end of the year. One will be a book based on a course that I'm teaching starting on Monday, called Presenting the Paranormal to the Public. So I am starting, I'll be teaching two classes. Our new set, our August session for the Ryan Education Center starts on Monday. I'm teaching two classes. One is Presenting the Paranormal to the Public, and it's for folks who are writers, who want to be speakers. So I get a lot of the ghost hunters who take our courses to take this. One of the things that I cover in the first class is how to talk credibly to people so that they don't think you're weird.
That's a valuable risk.
And how to, and basically how to talk to the general public about this in ways that won't get them walking away from you or scratching the head of like, what are they even talking about? Because there's a lot of that. There's a lot of jargon that's out there as well. But I talk about public speaking, other things like that. And the other course I'm teaching on Tuesdays is a course called Developing Your Intuition, which really is a misnomer because it's really developing your ESP. And it's based on it's exercises and a lot of the findings of the field from research explaining what makes people more psychic or less psychic and giving people exercises to learn to develop their own abilities.
Right. So you're thinking that ESP is the broader term of
Right.
intuition.
It's informational, non-sensory perception. It's
Yeah.
not a one of the things that unfortunately pop culture did is it made ES extrasensory perception into a sense. It's not a sense. It's not a sixth sense. Our sense of balance is technically our sixth sense. That's a physical structure in the body. I love, a friend of mine used to say sense of humor should count as the seventh sense. He said, too bad people don't have it.
Yeah.
And we're really talking about perception. I mean, I perceive the world through my senses, and then my brain fix my consciousness makes sense of it. It gives me a picture of the world. But I'm not necessarily seeing the world the same way everybody else is. So what we're dealing with is not extra sensory perception, it's extra perception. It's non-sensory perception that happens to be extra to our normal senses. So I talked to people in this course about how to bring that out, how to kind of really focus on it, get your other stuff out of the way.
Yeah. I know that we have a caller, but we only have 2 minutes left. But basically, she was looking for a different perspective on how the living hold spirits back. Are there, I mean, is it grief that might hold
Well,
them
I mean,
back?
it could be grief. It also could be that the apparition, the spirit, is more focused, just like they're sometimes focused on their homes that they built or something like that. They
Yeah.
may be possessive of their family. That could be, but it's not us holding them back in that way. That's their own psychology holding them back. There's no magic that holds them back. It's really not letting them go, whether it's grief or just simply you're not allowed to leave kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's been enlightening tonight. I would encourage our listeners to go on Lloyd's website. It's his name, Lloyd Auerbach, AuerBach.com. And you could
And
also,
one L in Lloyd, very important.
yeah, oh, that's right. When I, after all these years, I take that for granted, but a lot of people don't know that.
Right.
Lloyd. Also, there's information on there about his courses that you can take, the YouTube channel, and all of the books that he has published. Anything else you need to say before we part ways?
Yeah, I'll just mention there's also an FAQ, a frequently asked questions piece there, which talks about a lot of the stuff I talked about with apparitions and hauntings and poltergeists. That's all there. And there's even a resources page for links to a lot of great organizations, a lot of information about that, blogs, things like that, of credible information about all this stuff.
Okay, well, thanks, Lloyd. Thanks as usual. You did a great job. Wealth of information. Look forward to seeing you again soon. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Bye now.